Good evening, everybody. Tonight we're going to be listening to a little bit of Janet Frame. And for those of you who don't know who Janet Frame was, she was a New Zealander who was rather famously misdiagnosed as schizophrenic in the late 40s and spent the next several years undergoing several hundred rather severe electroshock treatments. In fact, she came really close to undergoing a lobotomy, like on the table, hold the phone and drop the coat hanger close. Actually, I'm not sure if it was that close, but it was rather close to undergoing a lobotomy, which might have ruined her. Until one of her collections of short stories won a major literary prize, at which point the doctor said, hold the phone and drop the coat hangers. Perhaps she's not crazy. Perhaps she's just remarkably talented. And so I offer you up that anecdote, should you ever want to use it, should you ever be misunderstood. And so, good evening. It is Saturday, the 13th of May, 2006, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Prizes by Janet Frame. Life is hell, but at least there are prizes. All so on thought. One knew of the pit ahead, of the grown-ups lying there, rewarded, arranged, and faded, who were so long ago bright as puppies. One learned to take one's own deserved place on the edge, ready to leap, not to hang back in a status-free huddle where bodies were warm together and the future darkness seemed less frightening. Therefore, one learned to win prizes, to be surrounded in sleep by a dream of ordinal numbers, to stand in best clothes upon platforms in order to receive medals threaded upon black and gold ribbons, books bound in cuff, scrolled certificates. One's face became, from habit, incandescent with achievement. I had my share of prizes, and of resentment when nobody recognised my efforts. For instance, year after year, when the New Zealand Agricultural and Pastoral Society held its show in the only drill hall, I made a buttonhole of a rose and a sprig of maidenhair fern tied together with raffia, which I entered for the flower display gentleman's buttonhole. It was never displayed, and it never won a prize. One morning, a militant woman in a white coat made a speech to the whole school from the front steps, before Bertie Dowling played the kettle drum for us to march inside. And in her speech, the woman accused too many people of entering for the buttonhole section, and advised us not to try to make buttonholes, as they were an art beyond our years that even grown-ups found difficult to master. "It has never been explained," the woman said, "why so many children enter buttonholes in the flower show." Bertie Dowling had the sticks raised, ready to play the drums. He was very clever at it. He was a small, sunburned, wiry boy with long feet like a rabbit. I felt antagonistic toward the woman visitor. Who was she to order me not to make buttonholes for the flower show? I persisted, as I say, year after year, yet always, once I had surrendered my exhibit, neat in its little box cage from the jeweller's, I never heard of it again. I had so much determination and so little wisdom that I never grasped the futility of my struggle, although I realized that, when talents were being devised and distributed, my name was not included in the short list of those blessed with the power to make gentlemen's buttonholes that would reach the display table at the flower show in the drill hall, and win first, second, or third prize. I won 6 and 4 pence for handwriting. At that time I was in love with my parents, therefore I decided to buy my mother a best china cup, saucer, and plate with the entire 6 4/5, even though at that time I also had a fondness for Sainte chocolate bars, jelly beans, and chocolate fish whose insides were a splurge of pink rubbery substance with tiny air holes in it. When I gave my mother the best china cup, saucer, and plate, she said, "You shouldn't have." And, wrapping the set carefully in tissue paper, she placed it in the sideboard cupboard with the other dishes that we never used, not even for the banquet to see the new year in, like the gravy boat, the tiny cream jug with a picture of a Dutch girl, the vegetable dishes with a picture of a rooster crowing on each one. Then my mother locked the door. I never saw her using the cup, saucer, and plate. It was best china, too, the man in Peaks told me. My mother always said she was keeping the set for when she could really use it, drinking out of the cup, resting a silver spoon in the saucer, tasting, with a cake fork, a slice of marble cake upon the plate. Although I could not discern the difference between using something and really using it, there was evidently a distinction so important that when my mother died, she had still not been able to use, really to use, my 6 4/2 gift to her. My next prize was for a poem that revealed both my lack of scientific knowledge and my touching disbelief in change by concluding with the lines, "And till the sky falls from above, these things of nature I shall love." Uncle Ted, one of my favourite wireless stations in Christchurch, read my poem over the air, between a recording of The Nutcracker, Waltz of the Flowers, and the 5th episode of David and Dawn in Fairyland, and 2 days later I received through the post an order for 10 shillings. With part of which I bought for myself an unsatisfactory diary and a John Bull printing set, which I used, printing my name and rude rhymes, and insults to the rest of the family, until the ink dried on the navy blue pad. The remainder of the 10 shillings I saved in a post office bank, which could not be opened unless it was taken to the post office. I broke into it with a kitchen knife when my bathing cap perished and the weather was warm enough for swimming. Prizes. They arrived unexpectedly, or I waited greedily for them at the end of every school year, when I received one or two, sometimes three, books with the school motto, "Pleasure from Work," inscribed on the flyleaf beneath the cramped, detailed writing of the farm mistress setting out the reasons for my prize. Reasons were necessary, for no school had yet learned to distribute prizes at random, first come, first served, in the manner that my mother had adopted in exasperation when she was pestered for raisins, dates, or the last of the chocolate biscuits. I collected so many books, Treasure Island, Silas Marner, Emma, poems of Longfellow with a hot throbbing picture of Hiawatha bearing Minnehaha across the river. "Over wide and rushing rivers, in his arms he bore the maiden." India, with illustrations coloured as if with cochineal. Boys and girls who became famous. And, during the war, when books were scarce, a musty old rained-on and stained volume of poems about blossoms, barns, and wine-presses, printed in tall, dark type, where snakes lurked in every capital letter. Prizes. Some did not get prizes. Dorothy Baker, with the greasy hair, never got a prize. Maud Gray, who found it hard to read even the simplest sentences aloud, never got a prize. Maud Gray. She was the stodgiest girl in the class. All the teachers made fun of her, and most of the pupils, including myself, followed their example. Her eyes were brittle and brown, like cracked acorn shells. Her face was pale and blotched, like milk on the turn. Years later, I was visiting ennui. I was walking desolately in the rain along the main street, wearing my dirty old gabardine and my dowdy clothes, and feeling 15 instead of 25, when, just beyond the bed of poppies in the centre of the street, I saw two beautiful women wheeling prams, and their proud gait was so noticeable I tried to recall when and where I had seen before that superior parading of the victorious. And then I realized that I had walked onto the platform in the same way, year after year, to receive my prizes. Dotty Baker, Maud Gray, as they passed with their cocooned, quilted, embroidered treasure, I could not even assert my superiority by whispering, "You cheated in history. You couldn't learn poetry by heart. You never had your name in the paper. First in geometry, French, English, history." They smiled at me, and I smiled at them. We shared the pit, each in her place. The rain poured upon the bed of crushed poppies between us, yet the delicacy and distance of the two women were unmistakable. I grudged their proud cloaks as they trooped, clients of love, on their specially reserved side of the world. But prizes, they never won prizes. My only retaliation was prizes, listing them, remembering. I wrote to a children's newspaper, sending poems that were awarded 10 or 5 or 3 marks. When I earned 100 marks, I received the usual prize of 2 guineas. For 1 guinea, my father brought me a tennis racket, as he said, on the cheap. But when he showed it to me, I was alarmed to discover that the strings were black instead of white, and the name was unfamiliar, Double Duke. I was the loneliest person in the world with my black-stringed Double Duke. Why had my father not realized that every other girl at school possessed a white-stringed Vantage? Ah, it was sad enough to have an old wireless at home with a name no one had heard of, and with tubes so few in number compared with the tubes in other sets. The conversations in class went, "Have you got a wireless at home? How many tubes?" The prestige of owning things mattered so much, and to have a tennis racket with a strange name and grotesque strings was punishment indeed. I was so ashamed of my tennis racket that I seldom used it. With my other guinea from the newspaper, I had the unexpected fortune to be chosen by Hessie Sutton, a woman up the road, as her pupil for music lessons, the piano, at a reduced rate, and every Tuesday and Friday after school I claimed an hour of Hessie Sutton's time in the front room of the house where she lived with her mother and a white parrot, whose perpetual screaming inspired complaining letters to the evening paper. The front room was large and carpeted, with sparkling bubble-shaped windows. The piano made wonderfully clean sounds as the keys sank into and sprang from their green bedding. The sounds filled me with a polished sense of opulence and cleanliness, and each note emerged bravely and milkily alone and poured into me up to my neck. I swallowed. I liked Hessie Sutton's piano. We had done it home. At my aunt's house, where I went to practice once a week, there was an old piano with soapy yellow keys that stuck halfway, and the lower or upper half of each sound had been weathered down so that each note came forth deprived, diseased, with an invalid petulance and stricture. "But you must not bite your nails," Hessie Sutton warned me. "You'll never be able to play the piano if you bite your nails." That was my first intimation that Hessie Sutton was a spy. I clenched my fists, hiding my fingernails. "At school," I said. "I learn music. Do you?" Dotty Baker, Maud Gray, and others learned music, but mostly they were like uncooked pastry at it. They suffered a dearth of warmth, expansion, gold finish. On the cold June days, when the music festival was held, we sat miserably in the hall, our coats over our knees, listening to a marshmallow tower being played by schoolgirl dentists and carpenters. My first piece was named Puck. I went down to the stationer's to buy it on tick, and the ginger-haired boy served me, and his face had a rust-coloured blush like a dock leaf in autumn, because he had to go to the small room at the back of the shop and ask his parents if it would be all right to serve me, as our bill had not been paid. On my way home with Puck, I met Hessie Sutton and smiled at her, shyly and excitedly, but when she glanced at the parcel under my arm, and the music half-wrapped, and gave an understanding smile, my face clouded in a fierce frown. How dare she see me and divine my excitement? How dare she? How I hated her. That afternoon, when I went for my lesson, she heightened my sense of shame. "I saw you," she pounced as soon as I entered the room. "I saw you," she said, like a detective giving evidence, "coming home with your new piece of music. I guessed how excited you were." "I wasn't caring at all," I said sullenly. "Yes, you were," Hessie Sutton insisted. "I saw it in your face. I knew." I did not understand why she should appear so triumphant, as if by seizing on a momentary aspect of my behaviour she had uncovered a life of deceit in me. Why, she honked with triumph like the soldier who brought back the golden horn from the underworld as proof of the secret activities of the 12 dancing princesses. I did not realise that people's actions are mysteries that are so seldom solved. I knew, Hessie Sutton kept saying, as I sat down to try out Puck. From that day, I no longer enjoyed my music lessons. I was weary of being spied upon. People were saying, observing me closely, "She's filling out. She's growing tall. Look at her hair. Isn't that Grace's chin she's got? And there's no doubt where her smile comes from." You see how derivative I was made out to be. Nothing belonged to me, not even my body, and now, with Hessie Sutton and her spying ways, I could not call my feelings my own. Why did people have so much need to stake their claim in other people? Were they scared of the bailiffs arriving in their own houses? I stopped learning music. I was in despair. I could no longer use prizes as a fortress. In spite of my books bound in calf, my scrawled certificates, the prize essay on the visit to the flour mill, and my marks of merit in the children's newspaper, I was being invaded by people who wanted their prizes from me. And now I lie in the pit, finally arranged, faded, robbed of all prizes, while still under every human sky the crows wheel and swoop, dividing the spoils of the dead.